Hi, JS.
Hi, Lance.
How are you?
Pretty good, and you?
Good, good. So what are we going to talk about today?
That's a pretty good question. So I was thinking to talk about the blockchain and Bitcoin in general.
The blockchain and Bitcoin? Isn't that all hype?
Yeah, just like the title of our episode, which is To the Hype Train.
But it is all hype, actually, right?
No.
Or mostly hype.
There's hype.
Okay.
But okay. There's good things.
I'm a skeptic.
Oh, that's good. I like skepticism. So, first thing first. What's the difference with the real currency? Previously, real, here I use hair quotes, even if you can't hear them. Real currency were backed by some tangible things, like gold. But pretty much every currency on the planet stopped being backed by gold. So in 1933, the US abandoned the gold standard, and in 1971, they completely stopped the convertibility of dollars into gold. So this means that right now, the US currency and pretty much every other currencies are backed by nothing except the country itself and the trust we have in the country, which is pretty much the same thing as Bitcoin, because we trust that it has a price and that people can use it like normal currency. So real currencies are closer to cryptocurrencies than we would like to think.
That's actually pretty trippy because there is no, exactly as you say, there is no physical manifestation of this value. It's just something we've universally agreed upon.
Yeah. So now we know. Real currency shit.
Done. And goodbye.
See you next week.
Yeah.
Alright, so no, really. So now let's talk about blockchain. So blockchain is a fundamental technology which the Bitcoin and most cryptocurrency uses. By itself, it's useful, but most of the time you'll see it just as a building block for other things. So let's read a small definition. The blockchain is an open distributed ledger that can record transactions between two parties efficiently and in a verifiable and permanent way.
So this really does go to like distributed systems.
Oh, right? Yeah.
It's not just some buzzword. Like there is some ground for it in an actual discussion and for solving problems like
this. Yeah. So here, one of the problem is to have distributed contracts between two parties that can't be tampered with or deleted once they're accepted. So you can trust the system. All right.
Sounds a lot like transactions and atomicity in databases generally.
Yeah.
Just as a parallel.
Yeah. I can see the link. But it's the same thing, but distributed. So how do you do it in like thousands of nodes on the planet?
Yeah.
All right. So the blockchain, as the name is kind of saying, it's a list of blocks. And a block is a batch of transactions. So, for example, transaction could be me buying a pizza from you, Lance.
My pizza is the best pizza.
Yeah. So this will be the example I'll use for the rest of the,
okay,
the examples.
Okay,
so
nice.
Me buying your pizza.
Lance's Pizzeria.
Yes.
Nice. Yeah, so these, this data structure really relies on the Merkle tree. And a Merkle tree is, as I said, a data structure. It's a type of tree, which I'm sure we'll cover a lot more in a future episode because there are lots of types of interesting trees in computer science. What's particular about this one, though, is that it's usually binary. And what that means is that every node has subchildren, and that it has binary would be exactly two subchildren. And it's important in a tree to know that these edges between these links between the parent and children are directional, and that it follows like a downward hierarchy. And so you can model anything as a binary tree, or not anything, that's an overstatement, but you can model lots of things as binary trees. What's special about a Merkle tree is that every node has a hash associated to it, and a hash is basically, it's a function which takes input and produces an output, and the input size is greater than the output size, so you could have collisions. And what's interesting about it, though, is that in practical terms, it's a condensed version of your input without actually knowing what the input was, if that makes sense. So to reiterate, it's kind of like an operation which takes any input and associates an arbitrary string with it. And there are cryptographic hashes. Those are the more important ones, I would say. And that it's that if you have any hash, there's not an easy way or not a feasible way for you to find the input that produced that hash easily. And that you, associated to that is that you won't have many collisions, right? Because if you have two inputs that result in the same hash, then you know that there's a collision and that could potentially be exploited.
So we can say it's a one-way function.
It is a one-way function. That's actually precisely what it is. Could have summed it up much better like that. And so every node has one of these. And what you would do for the leaf nodes, at least, is you would take whatever content is there. In this case, we could just do like the letters A, B, C, D as the four leaf nodes. So that means your tree would have like three levels because it's binary. So every node has an associated hash with its contents. And so for the example of leaf nodes, let's pretend like we had four of them, A, B, C, D. You would take the content, which would be A, and produce a hash out of it and associate it with that node. And so for parent nodes, what you would do is, since it's a binary tree, you take the hash of the two children and hash that. So you use those as inputs to your hash function, and the result would be the hash that you would assign to the parent node. And it's not very interesting in itself. The interesting part is that if you wanted to, you can bubble up this hashing from the child nodes, from the leaf nodes, to the root, and you would end up with one hash that uniquely represents whatever you're trying to model, whatever piece of data that you're trying to model.
So the whole tree is presented in one single hash.
Yep. And you might be asking, why not just hash the list A, B, C, D, which would be much easier in most circumstances. The reason why you wouldn't want to do that is that in this way, with Merkle trees, you can do you can hash subsets of your data set effectively. And so you could partially verify that only the A, like if you only had the A, you can verify that it's part of your entire data set A, B, C, D. And how you do that is you would say, if you have the A, so you hash the A, and if you had the hashes of its like associated partner in the binary tree, in its sibling, all the way up to the root, all you need to do is like assume those are computed and hash them all and make sure that you end up with the same hash that was given for you at the top of the tree. It's a little bit hard to describe in audio. If you can just go and Google search for the Merkle tree, it might make a little bit more sense to see this data structure. But what's nice about it is that, yeah, you can pick any individual node and know that it's part of the larger data set as a whole. You don't need to actually have the entire thing with you.
Cool. So, all right, perfect. So let's go back to the blockchain now,
yeah,
which uses the Merkle tree to represent transactions in a block. So other characteristic we have from the blockchain is, as I said, is distributed. So there's not a single server that holds all the information. There's many servers that holds all the information. So this means it's way harder to hack, because theoretically you would need to hack every single server on the blockchain to change the data or things like that. Also, it's, in the same vein, it's permissionless. So everyone on the blockchain has the same power on the blockchain. So there's not a single server again to hack to break the blockchain. You would need, in this case, to hack the majority of the blockchain, which is the 51% attack, which we might discuss later if we have some time. Currently, The Bitcoin has more than 10k nodes, so there's a lot of servers that we need to hack. So the power of the Bitcoin blockchain is that there's a lot of users. Something else that's really interesting about the blockchain slash Bitcoin is that it's a really simplified way of keeping your ledger. You don't need lawyers, brokers, bankers. You can cut all those middlemen and validate yourself that a transaction is valid.
Hmm.
Yeah, so cool. In the real world, there's a lot of use cases where you could just yourself know if the transaction is valid.
And what's cool about that too is that, I mean, it relates back to the Merkle trees, is that you don't need to download the entire list of transactions to be able to verify this. You as an individual can only have a subset and trust basically that the previous hashes are correct based on the consensus of all of these distributed machines.
Yeah, because currently, I don't remember the exact size, but it's pretty big. So 3 years ago, I did a project on it and it was like thousands of gigs, I think. Or something like that. Don't quote me on it, but it was big. It was super long to download.
Hmm.
So this, and one thing that people think when we say blockchain, Bitcoin is anonymity, but it's not. Like the blockchain doesn't give you any anonymity. Bitcoin doesn't give you either any anonymity. It's about you have a wallet, which has some unique number, and this wallet is used to do transactions. So the only anonymity that you have is that it's hard to find who has this wallet. But there's nothing more about anonymity. All right, so now let's dive into the Bitcoin itself. So it was proposed in 2008, at the same time as the blockchain. It was proposed by a guy called Satoshi Nakamoto, and it's not a real name. We don't know who is Satoshi.
Maybe it's me.
Maybe it's you. The blockchain was created to help Bitcoin prevent the double spending problem in the digital world without a central authority.
What's the double spending problem, JS?
Such a good question, Lance. So the double spending problem is, let's say I give you a digital token. It's real hard for me to tell if you already spent it once and you can't spend it twice without a central authority. So if there's a single server that keeps all the transaction, it's pretty easy. But if there's not a central server that takes a decision, it's hard to know that the coin was not spent once. So you can spend it in the future. Because like in the physical world, the advantage we have is that the coin is physical. So if you give it to someone, well, you don't have it anymore. But that's not a thing in the digital world, since you can copy data. So now let's go to the how does a Bitcoin works. So I'll give you a 6 easy steps that comes from the actual Bitcoin white paper.
Hmm.
Okay, here we are taking the position of a node. A node is a user of the blockchain, aka a miner. So let's say I want to buy Lance pizza. So this is a transaction. I send the transaction to the blockchain, so every node that use Bitcoin.
It's broadcasting it.
Yeah, exactly, broadcasting it. So each node receive all the transaction, takes the transaction, looks if they're legit. So this means if, let's say, I want to buy a pizza from Lance and it would cost 1 Bitcoin, they make sure that I actually have 1 Bitcoin to spend on Lance pizza.
It's a valuable pizza.
This is an expensive pizza. Yeah. Afterward, they take a batch of transactions, so my transaction and other people's transaction, and they create a block with it. So a block is a hash of the previous accepted block. An ounce being a random number and the list of transactions they think is valid. Afterward, they do some computer magic on it, and someone on the blockchain will find a valid proof of work. When he find the valid proof of work, it broadcasts the block with the valid proof of work to the other nodes, and the other nodes receive the proof of work, validates it's legit, and if it's legit, they continue on building a longer chain based on the new block. So here what we have is a chain of blocks, because everyone will start building upon the blocks they received. If there's two nodes creating two valid blocks at the same time, it's not dramatic, because one of the two blocks will be ignored by the mass, and the longest chain will win in the long term.
Yeah.
So this means that if you find a valid block, it doesn't mean it will be accepted on the chain. You only know in the future when everyone accepted your block and is part of the longest chain. Yeah. So now let's go to the proof of work. So the proof of work is the algorithm used for the distributed consensus here. So everyone agrees on which transactions are good and which transactions are not good. So as I said, a block is, you take the previous hash of the accepted block, a random nonce, nonce being a random number that you only use once, and the list of transactions that you think are valid. You hash this blob of data. So the hash is the same algorithm that Lens said earlier. So it's a one-way function that gives you some random-ish string. You look at the beginning of the hash. If you have enough zeros, it's a valid proof of work. And if it doesn't have enough zeros, you go back to step one. You take the previous hash, you take a new nonce, so a new random number, take the same transaction, and you rehash. At some point, you'll get a result, so a hash, with enough zeros. So when you have enough zeros, it means that you found a valid proof of work.
What I've always found strange is the use of the nonce. So it's non-deterministic, right? Like multiple people can, with different nonces, find different hashes.
Yeah,
I've always found it strange that the nonce is random, because how it's non-deterministic, and I assume there's some proof out there that with any nonce, or there exists a nonce in which you have the certain amount of leading zeros that you need to be able to validate that. I wonder if at some point someone will try every nonce, and based on all the previous hashes and all the things that need computing, there will just not be an answer.
That's really interesting. Let's say if this would to occur, you could change the transaction list. Since you are the one who choose which transactions are valid, you could just drop a transaction and replace it with something else and just restart again. But that's an interesting question.
And who knows? What if, based on that series of events, there actually is, irregardless of whatever transactions or whatever you hash, just based on all previous transactions, that
it shouldn't, because normally good cryptographic hash has a property that
it gets dispersed very easily, right?
Like it's perfectly dispersed. Yeah. So,
Anyway, it was just a thought, and I wonder if all Bitcoin markets will come to a crash one day because
there's
just
no
can't.
More nonce.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. And so here, the number of zeros is the difficulty of the blockchain. So the goal of the Bitcoin blockchain is to produce one block every 10 minutes. So if there's more people trying to mine a block, it would normally you would get blocks faster because there's more people trying. But the goal is that you only get one per 10 minutes, so the difficulty adjusts automatically with the previous blocks. Nice. So you always get approximately one block every 10 minutes. Let's do, what's the price of using Bitcoin?
This is where I feel like the impracticality of all of this comes into play and is where the hype begins. Like, where you can start calling it hype is because of all of these impractical side effects of using Bitcoin.
Yeah. So let's start with the first one, which is, I think, the more natural to think about, is transaction fees. So just like when you pay with Visa or MasterCard or whatever, you have a fee on the transaction. So on the blockchain, you can put zero fee if you want on your transaction. You're the one to decide. But if you don't put any fee, maybe no miner will want to take your transaction. Because at the end of the day, the miner that took your transaction and put it in one block will keep the fees. So you're incentivized to put a bigger fee to get faster in the blockchain. So currently, when I looked yesterday, on average, people pay 15 USD cents per transaction to be in the next 10 minute block. And in 2018, when blockchain was crazy, it was up to $1 per transaction. So this could become really expensive for a small transaction of like cents or like a pizza. Like $1 on a pizza is a lot, but on a $2 million boat, it's nothing.
Yeah. But yeah, I think the bigger problem is the uncertain delay, right? Because with any particular transaction, you don't have any guarantee that it's going to run anytime soon, unless you pay. I mean, unless it's very incentivized for miners to do that. So it wouldn't really make sense to walk to the nearest corner store and pay with Bitcoin and just sit there until it's approved, right? So I guess only for larger kind of asynchronous transactions it would make sense.
Yeah, you can wait, because normally you wait between 2 to 6 blocks after your transaction to be sure the transaction was accepted. Because as I said earlier, it's not because you found a block that the block will stay on the blockchain. It's only the longest chain that stay on the blockchain. So normally people wait between 2 to 6 blocks to be sure they won't be dropped in the future. So currently people wait around 30 minutes. And at the beginning of 2018, again, when it was crazy, people were waiting up to 3 hours to be sure the transaction was valid. This is slow.
Yeah.
So keep that in mind. And finally, I think the biggest one I heard like in the news and everything is the actual energy consumption of Bitcoin. Because the proof of work, we said earlier, is just taking electricity and doing nothing. It's just running hashes on hashes for no reason. So I found some statistics. Currently, they estimate annual electricity consumption of the Bitcoin blockchain is 49.5 terawatt hour. So this is twice what Scotland uses. So to run a Bitcoin, it takes 2 Scotlands.
Whoa, nuts.
This is huge.
And wasteful.
And wasteful, because you do absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
And in comparison,
just heating the earth.
Yeah, exactly. And in comparison, one Bitcoin transaction takes approximately more than 200,000 Visa transactions. So again, just keep that in mind. But it's not all black, because there's other way to have a consensus, which is not the current Bitcoin proof of work.
Yeah.
So there's alternative like proof of stake that some cryptocurrencies are trying to implement.
Yeah.
Which gives you the same security, but without all the energy consumption. So if Bitcoin would to switch to proof of stake, it would be maybe really good for the planet.
That'd be nice.
Yeah. And one other big thing that people might not realize is that if you did an error, there's no one to bail you out. Like if you send 2000 Bitcoin to someone and you mistype the address, well, it's done. You just lost your money. There's no one that will you can call and say, hey, that was a bad transaction.
No. There's no customer support
exactly.
Helpline.
Exactly. So that was the price of using Bitcoin. So now let's go into the hype, which I think is kind of interesting. Because since Bitcoin became pretty much like really famous, we hear so many companies like, yeah, I'll use the blockchain in that company and we'll solve all our problem. But will it? So what's the goal of the blockchain? Is to have a distributed consensus with permissionless blockchain with all the nodes having the same power. All right. So which types of challenges requires those things except a currency?
Yeah, very few.
Yeah.
I can't think of many off the top of my head.
Yeah, exactly. So many companies are proposing to do private blockchains. So this means that they control all the servers doing the mining or whatever they do. So you lose all the security of having a lot of players.
Yeah.
So for example, if a hacker could hack the one server that does the blockchain, well, he could change everything because he would have 100% of the compute power of blockchain.
Yeah.
So at that point, it's just a more complex database. So
yeah. Yeah, it is a much more complicated database. Yeah, and the point is that it should be a consensus, in which this case it would not be.
Exactly. So if what you want is visibility into your transaction, well, you can publish read-only replicas of your DB. Like, there's thousands of ways to solve your issues without using the blockchain, because most of the time you don't need or want the blockchain.
Yeah, agreed.
Uh-huh. And finally, something I didn't know about, like before last week, before I did my research, are stablecoins. I think this is one of the things that could actually be used for real. So it's just like a cryptocurrency, like Bitcoin and any other I don't remember right now. But the value of the coin is pegged to something physical. For example, gold. Or a real, here, air quote again, real currency. So GMO, which is a giant Japanese tech company, announced that in 2019 they will publish a stablecoin called GYEN, which is a cryptocurrency pegged on yen. So this means that if the yen goes down, the cryptocurrency value goes down, and if it goes up, it goes up. So no crazy fluctuation that we saw in the previous year on the block on Bitcoin, sorry. And 2 days ago, JP Morgan announced that they would be doing the same thing, but for USD, which is, I guess, the biggest currency on the planet right now. So this could be really useful because it would follow the price of the USD.
So does that change anything about the operations, or is it effectively just like sending a wire transfer, but that is, in quotes, anonymous? And that is, what does, other than the fluctuations in value, are there any other consequences to implementing a stablecoin as you know it?
I'm not 100% sure, to be honest, but how I see it is that you keep the nice feature of the blockchains, which is like open ledger, you know, that every transaction are valid, and small-ish fees, because $1 for like $2,000 transaction is low.
Yeah.
So you keep all that, but you don't get the crazy fluctuation. So if you buy one Bitcoin at $2,000, maybe tomorrow it will be valued at $1,000. So you don't get that.
I wonder how that like works in a sense, though, because like the value,
that's a good question.
Like the value is not intrinsic to the mining anymore, right?
So what I understood is that to get a stable coin, the company doing it needs to deposit this actual money in a bank.
Oh.
So it's actually backed by something.
Wow. Okay. That's cool. That's cool to think about.
If I'm not wrong, so this means that if you have one GN, you should be able to go to the company and tell them, yeah, give me that money. And they should be able to always give you exactly that price.
Wow. Okay, that does change things. I was, again, a skeptic. That's very interesting.
So, all right.
Well, thank you for enlightening me with all of your Bitcoin knowledge, JS.
Well, knowledge. Took me 2 weeks of research, but yeah.
That's okay. I just sat here the entire time. That's all right.
Yeah, it's perfect. So, yeah, the title of the episode was To the Hype Train.
I think we've proved that it is all hype after all. Maybe not.
Mostly hype.
Mostly hype. How about that?
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Lance.
Thanks, Jess. See ya.
See you in two weeks.
2 weeks. Sure. 2 weeks.
You can contact us and find show notes with references at randomlytyped.com. Thank you for listening.